One, two, one, two, three, four.
Hey, hey, it's Shay Keister, and I'm your host for Casual Cattle Conversations, where we talk about all things related to ranching through sharing the stories and practices of different ranchers and their operations. But first, let's hear from this episode's sponsor, the Red Angus Association of America. Value-added programs are on the rise in the beef industry as input costs increase and margins remain tight. Enterprising producers are exploring new ways to improve their return on investment and open doors to new marketing avenues. The Red Angus Feeder Calf Certification Program, the longest-running tagging program in the industry, is expanding and helping more producers earn premiums on their calves. The FCCP combines three important components into a single value-added program: genetics, source, and age verification. Cattle producers recognize the value of the yellow FCCP tag and continue to see market-topping premiums for a minimal investment by enrolling their Red Angus sire calves. For more information on Red Angus marketing programs and the FCCP, please visit redangus.org. Hey folks, it's Shay here, and thank you for tuning into another one. I am super excited for 2021 and all the episodes within it. It is February, and for those of you who are calving, well, I wish you the best of luck. And for those of you who are getting ready for it or getting ready for a bull sale, same to you. And even the people who are out looking for bulls. But with that, I'm excited for this episode with Bill Rischel. We talk about his experience in the beef industry, his story, as well as all the changes he has seen throughout his lifetime of being involved. So we'll talk about everything he's seen, how those changes were made, some challenges along the way, and where he sees the direction of the future of this industry going. So keep on listening. I hope you enjoy it. I know this conversation, it's a little longer, but I promise you the quality and content is worth it. So with that, let's get on to the episode.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, I'm pretty good.
To get started then, would you please explain your background in the agriculture industry?
Sure, I'd love to. And thanks for letting me be a part of your podcast. These are things that are quite new to my generation, and I think very important going forward. So I'm tickled to death to, you know, visit and be a part of, I guess you call it modern day technology and communication. So we need all of that we can muster these days, especially when we start thinking about our consumers. But to the question in my background, I actually grew up in the eastern part of the United States. And I was born and raised on a farm, general livestock and cropping. We had a small commercial cow herd that in, as I had two brothers, and as we became older over time, we were involved in 4-H, showed some cattle, and were quite successful at that, particularly steers. But Our herd was commercial to start with, and then eventually, piece by piece or animal by animal, we bought a few registered cattle, and eventually that became a small registered herd of Angus cattle. So I had a little background in that, was involved in 4-H, like I said, and did livestock judging and what have you. And so my goal was to attend Penn State University, which I did. I worked my way through school there and lived and worked in the beef barn in those days for $1 an hour. And, it was all good, great experience, lots of chores besides going to class and pretty much full-time gig. So finished a bachelor's degree and served a year as assistant herdsman with purebred cattle there at the university. And then decided that I was able to take a few courses. They were fairly cheap in terms of cost when you were employed there. And I decided I'd better take advantage of that. So I went back, finished a master's degree in animal breeding. And so that sits in my background and it fit quite well. And quite honestly, my master's thesis turned out to be extremely important and useful and valuable in my endeavor and lifetime with purebred cattle business. So that's the basic background. I was on a meats judging team there. I had a meats background. I was on a livestock judging team that was very successful. And ended up winning the 1966 International Judging Contest in Chicago. So that group of individuals were all similar people to me, folks who worked in the different barns there, whether it was horses or sheep or whatever at the university. I worked the beef barn. And those were fundamental experiences that were extremely valuable to what I wanted to do and was able to do later on in life.
Well, that is awesome. So where are you at now then? You said you started in Pennsylvania.
Well, we moved on finishing my master's degree. I managed two different purebred operations in New York State. The first one was at Phelps, New York, a place called Sarah Farms. We had a fair amount of success there, and that was with my older brother. I co-managed with my older brother at Sarah Farms. And then I had an opportunity to move on to the eastern part of New York, the Berkshire Mountains region, a place called Top Hill Farms with a guy who was a businessman in New York City. The most interesting thing in the world, his name was Harold Topple. He was a self-made, successful supermarket entrepreneur who got his idea for supermarkets while vacationing in Puerto Rico. There were no supermarkets. There were just stores. And he saw the need for that and the value of it and developed that and became a very wealthy individual and bought out a big chain of supermarkets in New York City at that point in time when I knew him and worked for him. And there's a great, great story behind that, because one day he came to me about 1971 and he said, I have these folks that would like to do some business with us. And he said, they've invited us to get on a plane and fly out to Dakota City, Nebraska. He said, if you're going to be in this business, he said, I thought you might want to fly along. There's room on the plane. And both my wife, Barb, and I took that trip, and we got to witness the first ever, just started operating at that point in time, box beef cryovac operation in the world. I had no idea at that point in time how much impact that experience was going to have on the way I would see things or think about change in our industry. The best way I could describe it was the experience to see this in process, going from hanging sides that would be packed in a refrigerated truck and hauled across the country to their in supermarket, where they would then be fabricated in the backside of that store and provided to our consumers. And now here we have primals put in a cryovac package, preservation, and by the way, a lot of beef safety included with that as well. And we would see that then, those boxes efficiently packed in these trucks. And you think about the economics. All the great changes ever took place in our business is based pretty much on economics, making it more economical, more efficient, a better way of doing business. I would have never had that experience if I hadn't managed Top Hill Farms for Harold Topple to see that happen and realize the impact that was going to have on our business.
Well, that is amazing. And, you know, it's a key theme to sometimes work for other people before you return home, or maybe sometimes start your own operation. So what other benefit did you receive for managing these other operations and working at the university while you were in college?
Well, as I said many, many times, I guess my goal was always to run our own operation. I don't think there's any question about that. But, you know, you can have a goal. It doesn't mean you're going to always achieve it at whatever level. The day that Mr. Topple came to me and said that he had some issues with his company and he wanted to concentrate on that, and I get it. That was his baby. It's like a herd of cattle is my baby, you know. It's, and he wanted to sell the farm and the cattle. And we had, in a very short period of time, without a great amount of expense, I felt like we'd put together a very, very functional set of cattle. I mean, extremely good for that point in time. And it was like, I guess I felt like it wouldn't have hurt any worse if you'd cut my heart out with a dagger. But I was respectful enough to know that it was his money. It was always his operation, and I worked for him, and I always respected the name on the front of my paycheck. And who was signing the front of the paycheck. And that's their decisions. And I was distraught, really, at the time that we were going to lose this good herd of cattle to work with. But I made one of the best decisions I've ever made in my life. And I look back on today and didn't know it at the time. But I did decide to stay there and help him. I knew he could get anybody to handle the farm, real estate, sale, that part of it. But I felt like for what he had offered us as an opportunity to work for him, that I at least owed him the respect to help him capture as much value out of these cattle as he could. And my wife and I and our small family at that point in time decided to stay there. And it took about 6 months, but actually helped to disperse that set of cows privately, split it right down the middle. And I selected the cattle to do it, had two different buyers that were willing to approach it from that perspective. And we sold that entire herd to two different buyers at private treaty. And I have shared this with college students today at different times and some of the work that I've done, that that's turned out to be one of my very, very fond memories. And one of the things that I'm quite proud of, that I just didn't pack my bags and leave because I was going to lose a cow herd that I thought was pretty special, which wasn't my cow herd. It's just one that I had the privilege to work with. And I look back on that today, and I think that might be when I start growing up in my life and realizing where your priorities should be.
Wow, that is amazing. And yeah, maybe they weren't your cow herd, but you sure spent a lot of time with them. So that makes a difference.
Sure.
So with that, you are located in Nebraska, correct?
That is correct. Moved to Nebraska in 1975. And in fact, that was at the same time following the sale of Top Hill Farms cowherd. I had said many times to my wife, even I think before we got married, that I thought someday I would like to live in the West, where this cow, beef cattle business and beef cattle operations, I felt like was the real world, the rubber meets the road. And for some reason, I had been exposed to the West a little bit and some travels at a young age. But I did recognize that. I always thought about the Dakotas, Montana, Nebraska. And I had been in all of that country for some crazy, crazy reason. It really did strike me early on that the water situation in Nebraska is quite unique. The Ogallala Aquifer, availability of water, and that seemed to me to be really, really important at that point in time. Well, if it was important then, it's 100 times more so today. And so we kind of landed here. I did work for an outfit called National Livestock Brokers. I did not have a job. We packed up three little kids, moved to North Platte, Nebraska. I didn't have a guarantee of a job, but I made some contacts with some folks that said they were going to need some help. And we did that, and we did that for just a couple of years and then struck out and went on our own. And when we moved from the New York location to Nebraska, Harold Topple was kind enough. He came to me one day and he said, "Well, I understand people in your business would like to own a few females." And I said, "Yeah, that's for sure. We do." I said, "It's important how it works. It shouldn't detract from the main goal, and that is your business." He said, "Well, you," he said, "why don't you design or write down on a piece of paper what a program would look like and what would be fair to me, the owner, and to you as an employee. And I did that, and I structured a deal where you didn't pay anything on a daily, weekly, monthly, or annual basis for running the cattle. But when you actually sold something out of those cattle that you owned, there'd be a percentage breakdown to the owner and to the employee. And the higher the price was, the more would go to the employee. The idea was to cover the running costs for the owner so that they weren't out any extra money. And at the same time, provide some incentive to run better cattle and to improve the thing. He accepted it. I did that. And we had, with cows and their calves and one bull, we had 13 head of cattle when we moved to Nebraska. What was fascinating was I took that same plan that I wrote up for Harold and myself, and I provided that to every employee that I ever had at Richel Angus. And some were able to add an extraordinary amount of money to their annual income through those sales and be able to grow their family and their lifestyle and whatever they were doing. So it was a pretty fair deal. It didn't work just for me. It worked for other people too later on that actually worked for us. And that's always struck me as a pretty valuable way to go about it. If there's enough respect from both sides, it works really, really well.
Well, that is awesome to hear and to see employees involved on an operation like that in those regards. So with that, you have been extremely involved in the industry your whole life, and you get to see a lot of changes with that. You've already touched on the changes when you made your trip to Nebraska and looked at the boxed beef process. So what are some of the other changes that you've seen made within the beef industry?
Well, there's always been the type changes. That goes without saying. They were incredible. If you go back to the 1950s, 60s, cattle were pretty small. And there's lots of reasons cattle were fatter. If you go back into the days of World War II and those times, there was a time when fat like that was used actually in the production of ammunition. And stories that I'm not very familiar with, but there's always been some economic reason for some of this, get right down to it. When I was a kid, I neglected to mention we would feed about 150 head of steers a year. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot to a lot of people, but growing up where I did, it was a big deal. Those steers were finished and ready to go to market. They would go to the Lancaster Livestock Bank of Students, out here in Nebraska, they call it Lancaster. Back there, it was Lancaster, you know, pronounced a little different. But that was a terminal market at the time, and actually the largest terminal market east of Chicago. Now, that's a shock for a lot of people. But that just tells you there was lots and lots of small cattle feeders in that part of the world. And the vast majority of those fat cattle, there was a huge kosher beef trade for the major cities on the East Coast for the Jewish trade. And the kosher trade only utilizes like the front half of the animal. And so you had the middle meats and the round and everything, which we value greatly in terms of the total value of the carcass. But that was very, very interesting. And so one of the changes in these type trends and the change cattle was obviously getting the bigger cattle that would grow faster, be more efficient, carry some more pounds. Again, it's about economics. Mm-hmm. It became a factor of how much beef or pounds we could hang on a hook in a packing plant because they're mainly their resources and their costs are spread across that amount of product that hangs on each hook in terms of what we call efficiency of production. Along with that, I just mentioned the terminal market that we hauled cattle to when I was a kid. And one of the greatest, biggest changes, again, having seen the box beef production line start, first plant ever, and now today, that's commonplace pretty much everywhere. But that basically was the beginning and the end of the terminal markets in our business. That's the way all livestock was marketed. You could have the great markets in Chicago. You had the great terminal market in Kansas City. You had great terminal markets of Omaha, which were actually an incredible facility, if you have ever seen pictures of those back in the day. Denver was another very, very big terminal market. Well, they're all gone today, and there's a lot more efficiency again where the buyers, the packers, have order buyers out on the road, and they're going to the feedlots, and they're buying the cattle directly. And the terminal markets have disappeared. That's been a major, major change. There's a lot of history. There's the memories from anybody who's ever been in the business and been to these terminal markets as a kid or later on in life. Is something that you just can't get away from. It was an incredible experience. But at the end of the day, what we do today is much more efficient in how we do it. And you have to be competitive in this world today from an economic standpoint and to be sustainable. We can talk about and would talk about sustainability in a lot of different ways, but in my estimation, first and foremost, to be sustainable, you have to have at least a positive attitude about the ability to try to make a profit. And if you don't have that, the rest of sustainability will not matter too much to your operation. So it doesn't mean that we cannot forego these other situations we're running in today that are extremely important. But we do have to be in a position where we feel like we can be profitable for our hard work every day.
Well, absolutely. And that is a great perspective to have. So one of the other changes that interests me is kind of on the genomic side of things. So what have you seen progress in that area of the industry?
Quite honestly, you know, my master's degree in animal breeding had a lot to do with genes and heritabilities of traits and the relationships of traits. How do we measure one sire from another sire? Most of my lifetime, we had no tools whatsoever other than some of our longtime experience, or we had the ability to have in-herd ratios, but also found out in time and learned that while in-herd ratios had some value just within that herd, they could be very misleading. Because at the end of the day, we now know with the heritability of genetic traits that there is far more environmental effect what happens in these matings than what there is in the genetic component. We found out that genetics is extremely important, but we have to do it the right way, and it requires contemporary groups that are properly structured. And if you have all of that, then these sires can be used in different herds of cattle, and you can eliminate the environmental difference mathematically. When you eliminate the environmental difference, you're working with what is the true genetic variance between those cattle. And that's what really has allowed us in recent years to make some of the biggest movement and changes in traits and economics in our business than ever before in history. And if you really want to get pretty technical about it, most of that's happened in the last 20 years. And so I date back a lot further back than that. And the last 20 years, I am thrilled that I've had an opportunity to breed cattle, be a part of an industry, and those things that have happened in the last 20 years in this business, because it's more exciting and challenging and compelling today than it's ever been in my lifetime.
Absolutely. And that's interesting for me to hear, because at 21, I always remember like my family talking about it. So were there any other changes that you wanted to kind of bring up or talk about?
Well, I call them paradigm shifts. You mentioned to me there earlier, talking about the presentation that I made mm-hmm. to the Young Producers Council of BIF, although virtually, I hated that. I really like being with people and being able to communicate and just have discussions about these things. But it still was a tremendous experience for me. I get on Zoom call today with you and don't think very much of it. That was a big, big step for me to do that with BIF and to be that far away from where that, you know, conference was planning to be. Mm-hmm. And just the number of people from around the world that were on that just is, talk about changes. There's one of the biggest changes that we've done in our lifetime is how we can communicate. And I figured I'd get into it a little later, but I've had the opportunity to serve the last two as a member, 15-member panel of the last two beef industry long-range plans, one in 2005 and one in 2020, which was just recently finished and presented here in the 1st of August at Denver. But we had two face-to-face meetings, January and February, and we were shut down due to COVID and had to do the rest of that long-range plan. Zoom calls are extraordinarily difficult to do on such a massive project as that beef industry long-range plan. We can get into that later, but mm-hmm. just saying again, other changes that took place, these are changes that we adapted to out of necessity. And I don't think there's any question that all business and industry will use from here going forward far sooner and in a far bigger way than they ever would have without COVID. COVID has forced changes that are not, most of us maybe don't like a lot of them. And some of them I think will revert back. But there's got to be some changes to our industry, and this is one of them. And it's not just us, it's other industries as well, due to COVID, that are going to be valuable. And I think we learn how to use those. That's part of change. We live in a time today where if we do not have an ability to accept change and be challenged by that and to try to adapt, as long as we feel like there's value in it, especially to be more efficient in what we do, more profitable in what we do, that's the greatest thing that students today should do, is learn how to accept change. Because as I said, I gave a commencement address at the Curtis School of Agriculture, part of the University of Nebraska, a couple of years back. And that was my comment to them, that leaving school, it would benefit them to learn how to look for change, to adapt, to adjust, and change when there was huge benefit to it. Because there's an old saying that the only thing that's guaranteed is change, or not guaranteed, or something to that effect.
The only thing consistent in life is change.
Yeah, the only thing consistent is change. My comment was, after saying that, I can guarantee you that the only thing that is not consistent is the speed at which it's changing. That's at warp speed today compared to what it was many years ago. And that shows up in our cattle markets. Our up cycles, down cycles, we have movements today in 24 hours in a week or a month that when I was young, your age, we wouldn't see that much change in a year in the cattle market. And so you talk about changes. There's so many of them out there. You could write an entire book with 20 chapters on it if you wanted to.
Well, absolutely. And yeah, things are changing fast, and that is neat to hear from your perspective. So what were some of the main challenges that came along with these paradigm shifts and innovations that you've mentioned?
Well, talk about challenges. some of the biggest challenges are willingness to accept. It has to do with accepting change, really. When we talked about the type changes that took place in the beef industry, it was all breeds. Those type changes were slow to take place, but when they did, there were market signals. Market signals forced that. There's no question about it. Pounds were more income. Didn't always relate to more profit necessarily, but it was certainly, if everything else was in order and in place, the fact that you could put more pounds on a larger animal and more pounds on that hook and more efficiency in the packing plant. I realized early on that the packing plant and our segments in our industry, the packing plant's the neck of the hourglass. Every single animal needs to go through that neck of that hourglass. And in all of our other segments, there's probably a lot more leeway, a lot more avenues, a lot more forgiveness, but that one is where every one of those carcasses has to go through that process. Well, that's a big economic factor. So what works at that level has a huge impact on what these cattle are going to look like. It's turned out today, and another one of these changes we've talked about, I mean, the Certified Angus Beef Program, for example, was the first ever branded specification run added value program. And that program, the specifications not only live, but carcass. And the combination of those showed us that there could be and was a lot more in these cattle than just an average commodity price. That's something this industry's really struggled with, is we now are debating, you know, how we get better price discovery for live cattle. And I get that, but we've come to a point in time where one of the biggest concerns or considerations in our business should be, what does the consumer think of our product? And I can tell you that's been a pretty long road, because in 1986 at Richel Angus, we did the first in our program and were one of the few that did structured sire evaluation for carcass merit. Keep in mind, EPDs and the Angus breed, they weren't available until 1988, 2 years later. So we were looking at carcass merit and decided there had to be something better about our industry that predicted or demonstrated or at least rewarded us for better carcass merit that would lead to consumers wanting to spend their hard-earned money for beef. And I always had the feeling that at the end of the day, most of us in the cattle business exchanged dollars. And in some respects, the only new dollars ever come into the cattle business are consumer dollars. And if they're willing to spend their hard-earned money, that's beef demand. And without beef demand, none of us have a business. Beef demand is the one component that's absolutely essential for all of us, regardless of what segment of this industry we're in, be successful. And not only that, but today, we always trusted our retailers, our distributors, our packers to take care of all this communication, promotion of the product at the end of the day. There were lots of people in the cow-calf business said, I'm in the cow-calf business, I'm not in the meat business. That doesn't mean anything to me. Well, it has to, if you're going to have beef demand, because we all have to be doing the right things. Mm-hmm. Beef quality audit deal showed us that we had top butt injections, abscesses, that were destroying a lot of product that had to be carved out of a carcass. And so all of the work that went into fixing that problem, today you hear nothing about injection site blemishes, because the industry and producers have done a phenomenal job of moving that into the less valuable cuts of meat, less problems with injections, and just, again, It's total carcass utilization that makes this all work. So I'm rambling. I get it. But I'm just telling you, this is not easy. There's so much interaction on all of these fronts. And sometimes these little things that we think we don't need to bother with, little things all add up eventually to big things. That's what I look at when I look at the beef demand. That's the big thing. And if we do the things that are destructive to that, that's both domestically and internationally, then we reduce beef demand, then we're going to have competitors like poultry and pork that will take that market share away from us because they're already priced competitive compared to beef. And if they start taking some of that market share away from us, that becomes a problem. So we're starting out with a higher value product, albeit I think one of the greatest tasting products with the most nutritious documentation to it that you can have in a nutrient-dense food that just does so many things well. We found out that through COVID, when we talk about how it impacted us, that some of the changes that took place in the business, those retailers and distributors, and in some cases packers, we always relied on to promote, sell this product and pull it through the supply chain. You can't push beef through a supply chain. It's like pushing a rope up a hill. You have to pull it through. That's consumer dollars. Well, we found out that a lot of these people who were responsible for promoting our product were more than willing to dip their feet in the waters of alternative proteins. And to my presentation at BIF, this was one of the things I touched on. It tells us that we better wise up, we better open our eyes, and fully know that while Packer may produce a alternative protein product. By the way, I'm not calling them alternative meats because they're alternative proteins. And in most cases, they're vegetables. You do have the cell cultured product now, and that's a little different. I think we need to be aware of what they're doing, but I will tell you in the long range plan, we still believe our biggest competitor is chicken and will be for quite a while. But when people you're working with decide to dip their feet into the waters of some of these other competitors, it tells us that we as an industry better wise up and spend some money on communicating directly with our consumers about this great value of this product we have. Not only that, but what these cattle do that is positive and valuable to the environment. Instead of being accused all the time of how they're destroying the environment, how they're creating too much methane and too much greenhouse gases and all that, we're learning that science-based information tells us that these cows on grass are doing a lot of positive things for the environment. And for society as a whole, and that where we're being accused of being a major problem with methane, greenhouse gas emissions, and what have you, that could not be farther from the truth in the United States of America. These are very positive things for your generation and for the people coming on, and we now are getting that information, and it is up to us as an industry to get that communicated directly to our consumers so that they can feel very, very comfortable spending their dollars for this product we call beef, because we know that a lot of these other folks have already demonstrated that they're willing to step out into these other alternatives. It doesn't mean that they're giving up on beef, but they're not going to go out there necessarily and do our hard work, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. This is something that this industry has to learn how to adapt. And if we're going to be here 20 years from today, it's totally going to be up to us. I think we're doing a great job with it. I don't think a lot of people know yet all the things that are going on that are really good about it. But that's to me, that's one of the most important things I could tell you today.
Well, absolutely. And thank you for sharing all of that. You shared so much there, and you might feel like you're rambling, but trust me, it does not come across that way. With that, through your career in the beef industry, you've mentioned your time with BIF and you've talked about the beef long range plan, but what other organizations have you been a part of?
Yeah, and I'm thrilled to do that. I look back and I wonder how in the world we kept an operation going and did what we did. I know, like everybody, we put in a lot of hours, but for some reason, I liked it. I met great people, mentors who meant so much to me as I was younger and getting into it. And I just, sometimes I would be a part of that, and I know it's volunteer, you know, work, but I would come home and I felt like I'd learned enough about people, their operations, doing things a little different. I almost felt guilty that I thought maybe I should have paid them to participate. and I know I'm stretching that a little bit, but the point is, there was a lot of value from it. It expanded my knowledge of the industry that I want to make a living in. And that's not a small thing. At any time you can expand your knowledge of how the other segments work, how other people do business, that's no small thing. But I started out in the 1980s. I was a member of the Nebraska Stock Growers. That was before the merger of the stock growers and the Nebraska Livestock Feeders Farmer Stockman Council. About 1989, 90, somewhere there, those three merged and became the Nebraska Cattlemen. And I just became a part of that as well. But I started out as a stock grower in Nebraska. At the same time, I've been a member of the American Ag Association since the first registered cow that Barb and I ever owned, which was 1966. And I then parlayed those things into, in the 1990s, I served 6 years, two full terms on the board of directors of American Ag Association and many, many different committees involved there I won't get into. I, at the same time, was on the Certified Angus Beef Board for those 6 years. And one of those years, I was chairman of Certified Angus Beef. My background in meats judging and some of those things like we talked about earlier all added up to bringing some value, I think, to that position. I was able to be a rancher and a purebred cattle producer who could sit in a meeting on certified Angus beef and know what they were talking about and, you know, kind of have an intelligent conversation about what we should be doing as a program and vice versa. I learned so much from those people back the other way that it had value in my operation. So that was the 1990s. In 2000, from 2000 to 2006, I served two full years on the Cattlemen's Beef Board, which is responsible, of course, for checkoff dollars, the dollars that come from producers. And each time cattle are transacting one way or another, the dollar a head goes into that, and half 50 cents of that goes to state beef councils. 50 cents goes to the Cattlemen's Beef Board nationally. Many of those state beef councils end up running their own programs, which are quite valuable and very successful, but they usually have some money left, and they might even let that go to big projects on the national level. So that was very important. But what happened when I was on the beef board, we had a structure at that point in time. We had one group of committees that was under what they call research and knowledge group. And one of those was product enhancement committee. This will probably touch on some things that most of your listeners might know about. I was extremely fortunate to serve as chairman of product enhancement at the time when we were doing the muscle profiling work. The muscle profiling was where we took carcasses and broke them down into, of course, muscle, fat, and bone, but each of the muscles in the carcass were segregated out into the individual muscles. So instead of like those cuts out of the chuck that used to be a roast, mm-hmm. there'd be three big old muscles together going in different directions. And we just threw it in a roasting pot to make it work because the mussels were all different texture, running a different direction, and it just wasn't like cutting a steak. So we learned a tremendous amount about that. And what's interesting is your college, University of Nebraska, was one of the major players in that, led by Dr. Chris Coffins, and the University of Florida, led by Dr. Dwayne Johnson. And U.S. Mark at Clay Center did a fair amount of work in that arena as well. That information has provided so much value to our business that it's beyond the imagination, where it broke down a chuck and certain primal in that primal into individual muscles like the flat iron steak and the petite tender and the Denver cut and the Sierra cut, and you go on. And all of these, at one time, a packer would have said, we're not going to do that. We're just not going to do it. Well, today, they all do it. And, you know, those cuts are value added. Instead of something at about $2.50 a pound, or a ground burger, or $3, whatever it is at the time, today that can be $9, $9.50, or whatever. So again, it was added value. It was economics. You know, I said most of these changes, economics will overcome whatever your concerns are almost every time, because we're market driven, and it makes sense. So that came out of my participation in that. And at the same time, it was that group that I was involved with there and chaired. We did the instrument grading thing, where today, you know, a very high percentage of these cattle now in the packing house are graded by instrument rather than federal graders. There's still federal grader oversight. There's still guys in the plants. But now there's a system in there that is technology and machine driven and very successful. It was a terribly long journey to get to that point, because it was so important that it was not only accurate, but also consistent. And they are not one and the same thing. You can imagine when your visual grader grading something that was low choice, just looked like high select to him, how many dollars difference is that on any given day? That's the producer may come up short. Could come up the other side as well, but get the top side. So from an instrument standpoint, it was very, very, very important that that instrument really got the low choice correct and the high select correct, that it didn't cause that fluctuation of value either side of that. It took quite a while to get the accuracy in that in the machinery. Today, it's quite well accepted, and I think our grading has been better because of it. There's been a lot more consistency in our grading. So that was that deal. And then I was involved in Nebraska Cattlemen. I went through the chairs there. I was president of the Cattlemen in 2010. Then with NCBA, more recent years, I mentioned the Long Range Planning Task Force. I was on the one in 2015. I've been on, I can't say for sure, but the first beef quality audit, so the beef industry by NCBA was in 1991. And I think I've been on every one. They do about every 5 years, and I think I've been on every one since. Tremendous amount of information gathered on the industry that made us all better. The injection site blemish thing that I talked about, it came out of those quality audits, and that's where it got fixed. And a lot of this has to do with beef checkoff dollars helping in that. It's a combination of things working together that's been very valuable to us. So these two beef quality audits, we just finished the one 2020 to 2025. And that's the most of it. That's not what it's been. It's all been industry related, and it's all been to try and make our industry better.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. So shifting gears a little bit, and you sure have been involved in so, so much, but what changes are you excited about as far as the future of the beef industry and what's taking place now?
Well, there's a couple. I've already touched on a few of them. I guess I'll start with genomics. I serve and have served since Dr. Pollack had come to U.S. Mark at Clay Center, started a beef focus group. And those are a few individuals from all over the country in there, from different aspects of the beef industry or different segments of the beef industry. And of course, the research that goes on at the ARS facility there at U.S. Mark is incredible. I know you're familiar with some of that. It is the most unique large animal research facility on the planet. And the good that has come out of there to benefit all of us as cow-calf purebred feedlot packers, eventually all culminating for a better product for the consumer, it is incredible. And yet there are some environmentalists and animal rights groups and many others who are constantly on the fringes of these kind of things, wanting to shut them down, close them down. And we can't allow that to happen. It has too much value to us. So the genomic thing has become a major player there. When we mapped the bovine genome in the beef industry a number of years ago, $1 million. And the amount of return on that investment, I'd have no idea what that would be today, but it's so much more than calculated because so many segments benefit from the results of that, what we're able to do. So to me, we haven't even scratched the surface yet on what genomics will do for this industry. Yes, we look at birth weights, eating weights, urine weights, carcass traits. We're getting some reproductive information now. But I can tell you that if we can figure out something in this genomic makeup, and I believe it's there, I don't think there's any question in my mind that there is a huge difference in individual animals in how strong their immune system is and how it's activated. If we ever capture that, most of the work that we've already done in genomics and we're so excited about dwarfs in value by getting to a point to where we identify genomics that will help us design cattle with a stronger immune system. We are being challenged today on antibiotic use and all of those kind of things. And if we can do something in the area of genomics and the immune system that will help us overcome some of those things that may be taken away or could make us deficient in, that would be an enormous asset to the industry. So that's one right there that I almost feel in my gut like it will happen. Okay.
That is a very neat topic to look into, is genomics and animal health. That's very
interesting. It's incredible. I have told some young folks your age that I was starting over today and wanted to be in the area of research or development and anything. I'd head there in a heartbeat. So that's really, really valuable. The other thing is that I'm excited about, I already mentioned it, and it's this younger generations. It's easier for them to look at this and see the value of it and probably a little more grasp of our whole industry, you know, the big picture, I would call it. And that is this thing to do with the value of the beef cow to our environment. The lower 48 states of the United States, I read an article a little over a year ago where it broke down all segments, grassland, crop ground, forest, military bases, golf courses, municipal. There's some I meet off forest. And it broke all of those down, and about 33% of all the acreage of the lower 48 states of the United States are grassland, categorized as grassland. Now, the interesting thing about that is some of our adversaries say that there shouldn't be any cattle out there, you know, destroying the grassland. The fact is we know now, and we have proof that properly grazed, rotational or whatever it is, we improve grass density, we increase capacity, carrying capacity, and those are economically beneficial to us. Think about all the wildlife people want to see out there that benefit on it. You don't have to go very far from your ranch or out on your ranch. There's deer, antelope, game all over the place. And these ranchers across America are taking care of all this wildlife too. Many of them more than willing to cooperate. So my point is that when we talk about the methane production in cattle, and we're catching a lot of flack about that, from people who don't even know which end of the animal the methane comes out of, by the way, because most of the methane conversation you hear is about cow farts, flatulation, or whatever, however you want to word it. And the fact is it comes from belching. But it's my take that some of these people feel like, well, it makes it a little dirtier and is more appealing to those who would want to agree with them, you know, if it has a dirty connotation to it. Coming out the other end. But Dr. Frank Mitlohner at UC Davis is, to me, a hero for our industry. He works in the animal science department there, but he's an environmentalist at trade. He's extremely bright, extremely intelligent. He's done the work on it. And his information shows us, and it's been verified, that I call it the half-life, I'm not sure I'm using it right, of methane is about 10 years. So methane does not exist or does not happen and enter the environment, the atmosphere, stay there forever. It breaks down. And it's about 10 years. Time is expressed in the atmosphere. It breaks down. And it can turn into carbon dioxide and other things. And those then, carbon dioxide, example, sequestered in what? Trees, corn, beans, grass, plants. Mm-hmm. Guess what? Cows utilize that grass to produce a phenomenal nutrient-dense, powerful food people off of land that generally, for the most part across this United States, would not have enough rainfall to support any other kind of farming or production. And even if it had to rainfall, a lot of it is, the topography is rough enough that it would not be good management of your resources to plow it or to open that sod up. So here you have what is now documented, a tremendous regenerative process that the beef cow is a major player on. And the beef cow is a major player of these, this 33% of all the acres of the lower 48 states, and of that 33%, 25% of that is federal lands. And it's extremely important to me that we get this message out, both legislatively and whatever way possible, the value of these cows on this land, because there's people out there that would like to dictate to us that no cow would ever run on public land. And we know for a fact that the land's better off for it, society's better off for it, people are better off. And if you look at the fossil fuel production of methane, electricity and transportation combined are about 75% of all methane produced. And that goes into the atmosphere and that stays. So we have a story to tell that's absolutely incredible. And the best story we've had to tell in my lifetime, and the best reason for these cows to exist and be a part of this, for us to maintain a cow herd in this country between 29 and 32 million cows, which is what it's been over the last 6-7 years up and down, it's extremely important that we don't lose the capacity to run these cattle, because that'll reduce production, that'll reduce product. Prices may get kind of high, but there's not going to be room for many people. It would be a tremendous reduction of operations, participation, and at the end of the day, create an opportunity for competing proteins to take over market share. And we absolutely can't allow that to happen.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. And you have answered so many questions that are all the questions I had and then some. So with that, what advice do you have for the current generation of ranchers before we wrap up?
Well, I think become informed. It's pretty hard to tackle problems if you're not willing to investigate and get the facts. It's easy to have conversations at the corner restaurant, coffee shop, what have you, and talk about all the problems and how you fix them. Well, it's not that easy, never is. And if you really dig into it and get the facts, the information, obviously, I like for people to get involved personally. A lot of people do not want to do that. And I've always said, if you don't want to do that, at least join an organization that you think is supporting your beliefs or causes or whatever, and be willing to put your membership online to let somebody do it who wants to do it, because nobody else is going to do it for you. It's going to be the industry. It's going to be producers that do this thing. And so those are some of the key things, but I think there's too many people who are voicing opinions on what is good or bad or who's right or wrong or anything else. And I don't think they really have enough factual information. I don't think they've made an effort to learn enough about what's really going on, about what has been accomplished in a positive way and is going on as we speak. Just a brief example. I don't know how many of your listeners would remember about July, August 2020. There was an ad, was it Burger King came out with the little cowboy on his stick horse with his cowboy hat talking about lemon.
We analyzed that in one of my agriculture and the social media classes. So
yeah, so you'll get a kick out of what I'm going to tell you. How long do you believe that that ad was on TV?
I never personally saw it on TV. I saw it on social media, but...
When I saw it on TV, but I can tell you it didn't last more than 2 or 3 weeks. I don't think it lasted 3 weeks. You know, you never know, because TV is, there's different feeds mm-hmm. to different parts of the country, metropolitan, rural, or whatever. I mean, they're not all the same, but some of them are. And this ad came out, and of course, all these kids are having fun, hooping and hollering and talking about lemongrass, and it's got to keep these cows from passing gas, and on and on and on. And we know from what we know actually in the industry that their information could not have been more wrong. And yet here's a major company that was utilizing this kind of an ad to promote an alternative protein product. My guess is, and this is dangerous, I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but I'm guessing that the upper leadership of Burger King turned all of this over to an ad agency to do something novel and creative that would sell more alternative protein product. And they had no idea, but Dr. Frank Mitloner, who I mentioned earlier, actually called them, got in touch with them, and informed them of how inaccurate and how little to no fact was a part of anything they said in that ad, including the lemongrass thing. That wasn't even proven. That was somebody's pipe dream at the time. Whether it ever becomes factual or not remains to be seen. Within days, we found out after the fact of that conversation, the ad was pulled. I never saw it again. I'm here to tell you that all of us owe him and people like him a debt of gratitude we'll never be able to repay, because that's what people with conscience, with some knowledge, with some education, like the leaders at Burger King, realized they were wrong and they did the right thing. Do you think that would have ever happened without our people who... Mitloner and his work and everything is hand in hand with the things that are going on daily at NCBA behind the scenes. And so that's just a great example that most people never knew about, never get to see, or for whatever reason, and understand the impact of those working behind the scenes. There are folks that are 24/7 monitoring advertising all over this country that relates to me. Anytime when any of those things come out that have an issue or a problem, they're on it as fast and instantly as they can be to see if it's got any traction to start with. If not, it's not that big a deal. And if it gets traction, to try to balance that out with facts and the science that we know are solid behind what we do.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. Is there anything else that you would like to share before we conclude?
You know, there may be a lot of other opinions on some of what I said. And my one statement to that would be is I've always believed that you can have your own opinion, but I do not accept that you can have your own facts. And so I just could leave it right there for me.
Thank you again to this episode's sponsor, the Red Angus Association of America. Growing and developing young bulls continues to be an ever-evolving process. How these bulls are raised has a huge impact on their success and longevity as they serve in commercial cow herds around the nation. As genetics change and are better characterized through genomically enhanced EPDs, seed stock producers are able to make more accurate bull development decisions. The Red Angus Association of America has authored an industry-focused white paper to provide seed stock breeders with greater understanding and perspective on bull development process. Red Angus recognizes the importance of moving the industry forward. Thus, a white paper on this important subject can offer valuable perspective concerning how seed stock producers should approach bull development now and in the coming years. Why All the Fat Bulls? Is available exclusively at redangus.org and explores insights gathered from bull sales across the nation, as well as data garnered from breeder surveys.
And that's a wrap on that one, folks. Thank you for tuning in. Bill certainly had so much to share. I wish I could have visited with him for hours about what he was discussing and really dive deeper into what he was sharing with us about his experiences in the beef industry. If you're interested in hearing more about any of the topics he covered, please let me know and maybe we can have him back. Please be sure to go give me a follow and a share, comment on my social media pages, whether that's Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, as well as help support me in adding more onto this podcast, whether that's webinars or supporting the time I put into the live conversations where I'm developing more of a community and a way for you to network with other followers of this podcast and have discussions about your own operations and changes and innovations that you are implementing. With that, have a great day and make sure to check out the Patreon program to support this podcast, and that can be found on my website, casualcattleconversations.podbean.com. Thank you. Have a great rest of your day.